Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good day, everybody. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is the 24th of March. We will listen to Master Tenjin Chosen's previous program, Anger and Patience, and please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and thank you for joining us today for Dharma Radio, where we've been talking about how to counteract the forces of anger and develop patience. There's a lovely quote from Linda Hogan, a Chictaw Indian writer who's much involved with environmental issues in America. The quote goes like this: "There's a way that nature speaks, that land speaks. Most of the time, we're simply not patient enough, quiet enough, to pay attention to the story." Now, isn't that so true for so much of our time? We're always in a rush to get somewhere, do something, and never give ourselves the chance just to be quiet and listen with an open mind. But it's not only true about listening to nature's story, the land's story. It's also true about listening to what others are saying to us. And so often, it's true about what we're trying to tell ourselves. We just don't take the time to stop, breathe, and listen. Although this program is about short-circuiting anger and developing patience, it is also about how to give ourselves the time not to react with our usual unthinking, rushed, habitual patterns, and to allow ourselves the time to react with more calm rationality, based on a wider, more compassionate view. To give ourselves the time to look at a situation holistically, instead of just focusing on this one small part that affects us directly, and reacting to that as though it's the whole story. Although it hasn't got anything to do with patience and anger, I am reminded of this story about Prince Siddhartha before he was the Buddha. When he was a young boy, and his parents took him to a harvest festival. The sun was shining in a clear blue sky, and the prince sat in the shade of a large tree to watch what was going on. At first he was very happy. It was a beautiful day. The farmers were steadily ploughing the fields. Birds were flying around, chirping merrily, and everything seemed very pleasant. But then, as he looked more intently, he noticed how the men pushing the ploughs were sweating and straining in the heat. The oxen were forced to go up and down the fields, up and down, pulling the heavy plough without a break under the hot sun. He saw that the birds were following the farmers, eating the worms and insects turned up by the ploughs. He saw also how snakes in the field were ready to strike at any bird that came close. But they themselves were in danger of being killed or maimed by the farmers or the ploughshares. The boy saw that what at first appeared to him as a pleasant summer scene was actually filled with toil and suffering for so many creatures that a great well of sadness and compassion arose in him. So it is with us when we are involved in a troublesome situation in which anger easily arises. We are quick to judge on the evidence which appears immediately to our senses. But if we slow down, delay our reaction, and look more closely, we often will see that there's so much more to the situation than is immediately apparent. And so our whole reaction changes, usually with more compassion and less anger. So this is what the text we are following, Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, is teaching. It shows us how we can think, how we can see a situation to minimize the chances of anger overtaking us and ruining both ourselves and those around us. But before we go on with the text, let's take a moment to examine our motivation for being part of this program. As I've said before, motivation is the most important part of an action and determines whether the action is positive or negative. If we want a positive result from an action, we must have a positive motivation. Otherwise, only suffering will result. So to make this program worthwhile, let us set our motivation to be as positive as possible. From a Buddhist point of view, that is so it is a cause for our enlightenment, so we can be of the greatest possible benefit to others. Please try for that motivation, but if that is too great, at least think that this program will help you to become an arhat. Thank you. Now last week, Shantideva, arguing against our getting angry with people that harm us, said that beings are so caught up in their delusions that we should not expect them to not harm us. The delusions are so strong that beings even harm themselves up to the point of killing themselves, even though they have great attachment to their bodies. An obvious example we used last week was suicide bombers who destroy themselves in the mistaken belief that killing their enemies as they destroy themselves will result in some kind of paradise for them. If beings have such delusions, how can we expect them not to harm us? And seeing this, if we can't develop any compassion for them, at least we should not do anything to harm them, as they are like insane people. And most people will not want to hurt others they know to be insane, even though the insane people may be creating harmful actions. Shantideva goes on to say that if people are by nature angry, then we just have to accept it, as we can do nothing to change them. But if they're only occasionally harmful in certain circumstances, it would be as foolish to be angry with them as it would be to develop anger for the sky, because it has clouds passing through it. Then Shantideva takes the example of someone harming us with a weapon, and points out, first of all, that we get angry with a person, although it's actually the weapon that is harming us. To the objection that it is the person who wields the weapon, Shantideva replies that the person is under the influence of anger, so actually anger is wielding the person, so we shouldn't get upset with the person, we must regard the anger as our enemy. Secondly, he says, we have to remember that if we had not created the karma to be attacked, the attack would never have happened. So we are at least partly to blame for the harm against us. In the last verse we looked at last week, he states, their weapons and my body, both the causes of my suffering. They their weapons drew, while I held out my body. Who then is more worthy of anger? Which means that we took on this body through our negative karma, and so created the conditions for the harm inflicted on us. If we had not created that karma, or the karma to be attacked, even though the enemy with a weapon was ready and waiting, he or she would not have had the opportunity to use the weapon against us. So how can we say unequivocally that we are an innocent party? Now Shantideva continues with that theme. He says, this human form is like a running sore. Merely touched, it cannot stand the pain. I am the one who clings to it with blind attachment. Whom should I resent when pain occurs? Here Shantideva points out all that is wrong with taking this human body. Some people think this human body is truly a wonderful thing. And it is true, it's an instrument to create many fascinating things and situations. However, if we put aside our fantasies about it and really look at it, we will come to see that it's not really the wondrous thing we're so enamored of. Shantideva says it's like a running sore, and we all know what that's like. Take a blister, for instance. Even the slightest touch makes us cringe with pain. Our body is like that. Well, what happens when someone you really don't like comes up and pats you on the back? Isn't there an immediate sense of unease and withdrawal? You know, you have incidents in your life which are really minor, which stick in your mind ever afterwards. I had one such incident when I was a teenager, and had gone somewhere with my parents where there were lots of people I didn't know. I cannot remember where it was or what the occasion was, but I do remember one rather pretty girl sitting some way away from me. Because it was a room of strangers, I didn't have much to say and just sat a little dumbfounded and looked around. I glanced occasionally at the girl, merely in the course of trying to be interested in what was going on. But when we all got up to leave, she launched a tirade at me about how dare I stare so much at her. I was completely taken aback and stunned into silence, which probably made the other people believe I had been staring at her. But I'd had no intention of gazing at her in particular at all, pretty girl or not. It's like that often with us, isn't it? We're so sensitive about ourselves, and in particular our bodies, that even something that quite unintentionally intrudes in our space or touches our body sets us off. And so Shantideva says that if we're so very attached to something that is actually just a bag of nerves waiting to be hurt, why should we react with anger when it is harmed? This human body is formed from negative karma and afflictive emotion, and so inevitably it will suffer. By its very nature, it is prone to suffering and dissatisfaction. But instead of recognizing that and or wanting to be free of it, we cling to it as if it's our most precious possession. But it's always getting us into difficult situations, and our suffering comes from being so ignorantly attached to something that is a byproduct of negativity and so cannot help but be in the way of suffering. We who are like senseless children shrink from suffering but love its causes. We hurt ourselves. Our pain is self-inflicted. Why should others be the object of our anger? Our major problem is that we don't want suffering, but we have no idea what its real causes are, so we continually create those very causes. What are the causes? Well, in particular, the 10 non-virtuous actions. That's killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh words and gossip, wrong views, ill will, and covetousness. For instance, we don't want to suffer, but we have no compunction at all about going fishing and making other beings suffer enormously. How can we possibly think that the result of an action that deprives another being of their most precious possession, their life, will bring us happiness in the long term? For the very short term, we may get some happiness by eating the flesh of the fish, but the actions of intentionally going out to catch a fish, then catching it and eating it and rejoicing in doing so, makes for a complete killing karma that will mean a life of intense suffering for us in the future. And so we cannot blame our suffering on the other beings who are really only the conditions which make the karma ripen. We have to blame ourselves and our selfish, harmful way of acting. In his commentary to this text, His Holiness the Dalai Lama uses the Gulf War as an example. Everyone blamed Saddam Hussein for the invasion of Kuwait and the subsequent problems in Iraq. But His Holiness asks, where did Saddam Hussein get his military hardware from in the first place? Many factors involving many nations came together to allow Saddam Hussein to do what he did. So each of those nations should shoulder some of the responsibility. But we tend to focus our blame on one factor in an effort to exonerate ourselves from responsibility. And what does this say about New Zealand and the way we treat animals, like farm animals and chickens, particularly in batteries? I remember going to retreat in Nelson some time back at a center out in the rural area of Sunshine Valley. Next door was a dairy farmer, and every evening we were treated to the young calves, perhaps not yet properly weaned, but who had been separated from their mothers, crying out, and the distraught cows plaintively calling back. And we knew that if the calves were male, they were destined for the slaughterhouse before they were even teenagers. How can we expect to have good conditions and happiness in the future if we create such negativity for the sake of our selfish desires for milk and meat. His Holiness also uses the example of the Chinese invading Tibet. He says many factors contributed to the situation, not only China. In previous generations, Tibetans were warlike and rough people. So how could they not expect to reap the results of that? In every situation, we are also responsible for the unfolding of events. So we can't just sit back and blame others when things get tough. But that's what is easiest to do, isn't it? We don't really want to acknowledge our own responsibility, so we conveniently try to sidestep our part in it. But Shantideva challenges that, saying, "Who indeed should I be angry with? This pain is all my own contriving. Likewise, all the janitors of hell and all the groves of razor trees. The cause for all our suffering is the negative karma we have created. From the thief who steals $5 from our wallet to the guardians of hell, if we hadn't created the karma to have the experience, we would not reap the suffering. So in this sense, our suffering is not due to the thief or the hellish demon. It's our own self-obsessed mind that creates harm and thinks it can get away with it. Those who harm and come against me are summoned by my evil karma. But they will be the ones who go to hell, and so it is myself who brings their ruin." And now Shantideva shows us that although it appears that my enemies cause me harm, it is my negative karma which allows them to hurt me, the result of which will be that they will go to hell in a future life. So actually, they are not harming me. I am harming them. Because of them, and through the exercise of patience, my many evils are cleansed and purified, but they will be the ones who, thanks to me, will have the long-drawn agonies of hell. Therefore, I am their tormentor. Therefore, it is they who bring me benefit. Thus, with what perversity, pernicious mind, will you be angry with your enemies? When someone is angry with us, we think they are our tormentors. But actually, it is the other way around. We are the tormentor, and they are the tormented. That person who is irritating us is giving us a good opportunity to practice patience. And if we take that opportunity, they are benefiting us a great deal. Often in Tibetan Buddhism, it is said that your enemy is actually your greatest friend. If you think about it, our friends give us very little opportunity to practice patience. Usually our friends are very nice to us. They're understanding and back us up when we get into difficult situations. Only our enemies give us the chance to really practice patience. And if we're wise, we will gladly take that opportunity and use it to our advantage, not getting angry at our tormentor. Just realizing that by harming us, they are creating so much suffering for themselves in the future, Shantideva describes it as the long-drawn agonies of hell. Instead of feeling anger and frustration, we can develop some compassion for them and maintain the peace of our own minds. The more we can train in this way of thinking, the more easy it will be to counter another's anger with patience and compassion. And that is a very good way to purify the many negative imprints of anger we have previously placed on our mind. So not only does the enemy allow us to practice patience, he or she also purifies our negative karma. Yet even knowing these immense benefits, the mind still wants to seek revenge and cause more suffering in the future for itself. How perverse is that? But then you might ask, well, if I'm the tormentor of the other person and giving them the opportunity to create negative karma, won't I also be born in a state of suffering since I'm causing their downfall? And also, if the person is giving me the opportunity to practice patience and tolerance, won't that produce positive karma for them? Shantideva investigates the two questions in the next verse. "For if a patient quality of mind is mine, I shall avoid the pains of hell. But though indeed I save myself, what of my foes? What fate's in store for them? And then he goes on, if I repay them harm for harm, indeed they'll not be saved thereby, and all my nobler actions will be spoiled, austerity of patience brought to nothing. Shantideva says that the karma is accumulated by the mind that produces it. So if I develop patience and tolerance, I produce positive karma, or at least avoid accumulating negative karma. So I will not have to suffer the pains of the lower realms. But if I pay harm for harm, it certainly will not help the other person, and it will spoil all the positive actions I've built up until then. Whatever fortitude I've built up through patience and tolerance will be tainted and harmed. In his commentary, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that when we return harm for harm, it creates a vicious circle. If someone harms us and we retaliate with revenge, our opponent will then return the vengeful harm, and so it goes on. Such a feud can spread to a community level and go on, and the whole purpose of life is spoiled. We have just such a situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Every time one side attacks the other, the harm is returned, which merely incenses more revenge, and so the whole ugly mess never comes to an end. The more entrenched each side becomes, the more hatred for the other is generated, and the more harm is created. We can also look at the Sunni and Shiite factions in Iraq. Will they ever stop throwing human bombs at each other and learn to live peacefully together? Not until they change the anger and hatred and develop patience, love, and compassion. Does this mean, though, that when someone does something to harm us, we should just meekly accept it? His Holiness says maybe the best course is to run away quickly. Which reminds me of some years back when a high lama by the name of Lama Chimi was here and gave a talk in Auckland. Many different kinds of people went to the talk, and in the question time, someone asked Rinpoche what to do if you were encircled by a gang of men who were about to do some very nasty things to you. The person who asked the question looked, if I remember correctly, a little as though it was a situation he was not unfamiliar with. Anyway, Lama Chimi Rinpoche said to him, pick one, hit him as hard as you can, and then run as fast as you can. Which, of course, made us all fall about with laughter. But the point was that it was not necessary to just lie down meekly and let people walk all over you. You may have to take some drastic action, but the important thing is what you're doing with your mind. If the motivation is hatred and anger, we're really in trouble. But if we keep the motivation of love and compassion, even in the face of serious harm, we can still act forcefully, but our minds will not be under the sway of negative emotion. So we will not create negative karma, and so we will not experience so much suffering in the future. Which leads to the question of how far our patience and tolerance should go. His Holiness mentions that it is possible to stay so focused on one's practice that we can give away our whole body if necessary. But we should only do that when we are ready. Someone who has practiced extensively and has high realizations can do such a thing if needed without suffering any negative consequences. However, for those mere beginners like myself, it's better to preserve our bodies and deal with the situation in a different way, like hitting hard and running away, but preserving a patient level of mind. And that is where we're going to leave Shantideva today. Now I'm going to read more from the Golden Light Sutra, which brings peace individually and around the whole world. Last week we started the second chapter of the Golden Light Sutra. If you remember, the Bodhisattva Ruchira Ketu was wondering why Shakyamuni Buddha only had a lifespan of 80 years. While thinking that, his house transformed into a beautiful environment with four Buddhas in the four directions, who told him nobody could perceive the lifespan of the Buddha Shakyamuni. We continue. As soon as those Tathagatas expressed this observation on the lifespan of the Tathagata Shakyamuni Buddha, then by the power of the Tathagata, the gods residing in the desire and form realms, including Nagas, Yakshas, Gandhavas, Asuras, Garudas, Kanaras, and Mahoragas, as well as numerous hundreds of thousands of millions of bodhisattvas, gathered and went to the house of the bodhisattva Ruchiraketu. Then those Tathagatas proclaimed in verse this explanation of the lifespan of Tathagata Shakyamuni to the entire gathering. The drops of water in all the oceans can be measured, but no one can measure the lifespan of Shakyamuni. To the finest particle, the atoms of Mount Sumeru can be gauged, but no one can gauge the lifespan of Shakyamuni. The number of finest particles existing on this earth can be measured, but not the span of the conqueror's life. Although through some device one may wish to measure space, no one can measure the lifespan of Shakyamuni. The number cannot be found that explains the fully enlightened Buddha lives this long, this many eons, in eons terms such as 100 million eons. There are two causes and two conditions for this: renouncing deadly violence and repeatedly giving plentiful food. The finite count of the lifespan of this great being that explains he will live this many eons cannot be found. The eons are indeed uncountable. Hence have no doubt, not even the slightest doubt, the finite limit of the conqueror's life is not observed anywhere. Then at that time, in that assembly, the Brahman teacher and expounder called Kaundinya, along with numerous thousands of Brahmins, venerated the Tathagata. On hearing the voice of those great Tathagatas, completely gone beyond sorrow, they gathered in that place at once. Bowing at the feet of the Tathagata, the Brahman teacher and expounder Kaundinya said to the Tathagata, "If the Lord Transcendent Victor is merciful to all living beings, compassionate, desirous of serving, apparent to all, equal to the unequaled, illuminating like the moon, wisdom and knowledge glowing like the sun, if you look upon all beings as upon your son Rahula, then please give me some guidance." The Tathagata remained silent. Then through the power of the Tathagata, in that assembly a confidence grew in a Lachavi youth called Savalokapriyadarshana. And he spoke thus to the Brahman teacher and expounder Kaundinya, "Why do you seek guidance, great Brahman, from the Buddha? I will give you the guidance you seek." The Brahman said, "For the sake of honoring the Buddha, Lachavi youth, and for the sake of receiving a share of relic powder, I wish to have a relic of the Buddha, the size of a mustard seed. It is said that if one honors a relic the size of a mustard seed, one attains lordship over the gods of the 33. Listen, O Lachavi youth, to the King of Glorious Sutras, the sublime golden light, which has features and qualities such as being difficult for all Shravakas and Pratekya Buddhas to know and to comprehend. O Lachavi youth, the Sutra of sublime golden light is in this way difficult to know and difficult to comprehend. Hence we Brahmins of remote areas wish to have a relic the size of a mustard seed, which when held, either placed in a bowl or kept on the body, causes living beings to attain lordship over the gods of the 33. Why wouldn't you, O Lachavi youth, wish to receive a relic the size of a mustard seed from the Tathagata and keep it in an urn so that living beings may attain lordship over the gods of the 33? O Lachavi youth, I seek such a boon." And now we run out of time, we must leave it there. Thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Please take a moment to dedicate whatever positive potential we've developed through this program to gaining enlightenment. Thank you.